From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Saratoga.
Presidio.
San Francisco, California, Excelsior District, District 11.
Coming up, we talk to Bay Area residents hoping to get citizenship before November.
I think the current presidential campaign has a lot of non-U.S. citizen-born folks feeling pretty anxious.
Then an Oakland photographer captures beauty and struggle in low-income communities of color.
You know, we are love, but we are at war. We feel it when we walk outside.
And we learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
So here's another example of queen termites. So you can see it's got this tiny little brown body here, and the white stuff is just her abdomen full of eggs.
Bugging out today on Cross Currents. Stick around.
Oh my God.
Applying for citizenship can be an intimidating process. There is a 20-page application, an employment history, travel records, and an interview. And then there's the final exam. Why does the flag have 13 stripes? What does the president's cabinet do? What's an amendment? But you don't have to go it alone. Every year, Services, Immigration Rights, and Education Network hosts a series of events in San Jose to help people get started. The most recent gathering brought lines much longer than usual. One explanation? Election season. KALW's Lila Day brings us the story.
Today at the San Jose City College campus, hundreds of people have shown up to go through a series of steps to get them closer to becoming U.S. citizens. This orientation is in Spanish, but it's also presented in Cantonese, Farsi, Vietnamese, and other languages. Hands shoot into the air with detailed questions. If I left the country for a month, is that okay? If I divorce and my name change, will that affect my application? How long will this process take? Today, more than 1,300 people are here to get help with applying for citizenship. After orientation, people line up to enter a huge auditorium to begin the second step, filling out paperwork.
I'm waiting to fill out an application for citizenship. I'm waiting for my turn in Spanish.
Rocio, who just made her way in here, is now waiting in another line to determine if she's eligible. Rocio's from Mexico, but she now lives in San Jose. She didn't want to use her last name. She's been a resident for 5 years. That's one of the requirements for those applying for citizenship. She says she's here today for a very important reason.
Porque es gratis.
Because it's free.
The room is full of volunteer lawyers and law students who are here making sure everyone has the right documents in order to move forward as citizens. Organizers say the turnout is nearly double the amount of people compared to last year, which is normal for an upcoming election. People want to have a voice in the vote. Rocio nervously sits down and hands a questionnaire to a volunteer to see if she can move on to the third step.
So you gave her a green stamp. What's that for?
The green stamp means she can go to the next station and fill out the forms. So she's eligible to go and apply.
Rocio moves on to step three, which is filling out a 21-page application. The crowds of people continue to pile in. Right now, around 46% of Hispanics are eligible to vote in California, and more than half of them are already naturalized citizens. In that same line is Soledad Estrada. She's sitting in a plastic chair with her paperwork in hand.
Quiero ser ciudadana.
I want to be a citizen.
Estrada's been a resident for 12 years, and now she wants to vote in November.
I don't agree with Donald Trump and his political ideas.
In this election, some candidates' ideas have been very anti-immigration.
I think the current presidential campaign has a lot of non-U.S. citizen-born folks feeling pretty anxious.
That's volunteer attorney Jacqueline Kelly Widmer from San Francisco's La Raza Centro Legal.
They want to make sure that they become citizens before that happens and also get out the vote.
On the other side of the auditorium, people are making their way toward the final step, where their applications are reviewed by a lawyer.
Elmer Guido? Elmer Guido?
Elmer Guido is sitting next to his 6-year-old son, who's playing a game on his dad's phone. Guido says today is very important for him.
Queremos dar un paso más.
We are here because we want to move forward. We came with a dream about this country, and we want this dream to come true.
Guido's from Nicaragua. His son was born here, and he's been a resident for 6 years. He was actually eligible to become a citizen last year, but he didn't move forward with it. Now, he wants to vote.
This is a country of immigrants. We want this country to move forward. I don't agree with Donald Trump. His politics are totally irrational. He uses a lot of violence with his words, not just for our community, but for the entire country.
Around 60% of the people here today will successfully apply for citizenship. Once all the forms are ready, the volunteer attorneys go over every question again with a fine-tooth comb. If it's all good, those applying will pay $680 to submit their application in the mail. Elmer Guido smiles big as he receives the news that his application is ready to be submitted. Others, like Soledad Estrada, are leaving with bad news.
I have to wait 3 more years to become a citizen because I don't know English. I don't speak it, I don't write it.
Estrada wants to take the exam in Spanish, and although she's been a resident for 12 years, the rules say she'll need to wait 3 more years to take it in Spanish. She's very upset. Her walker is shaking in her hands when she tells me this. But Estrada is most angry that she won't be able to vote.
It's not fair because the Mexicans, Latinos, do all of the work that Americans won't do. If it wasn't for the Latinos, nothing would happen. The economy would fail.
When I ask her what she'll do now that she can't vote, she says she'll have to spread the word herself.
Don't vote for Donald Trump. Vote for someone who means well for the Latinos.
There's another citizenship workshop this coming weekend, and many here will be returning with documents that they weren't able to provide today, hoping to make the deadline to be able to register to vote in the presidential election. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
Citizenship applications take about 5 months to process, so people wanting to apply in time to vote in November should have all forms in the mail by mid-April. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Photographer Brittany Sensabaugh came up in East Oakland surrounded by fast food restaurants, liquor stores, and check cashing places. Other parts of Oakland looked different. Inequity was something she could see. When she graduated high school, her older brother gave her a camera, but it wasn't until years later that a chance encounter led her to start taking pictures of familiar faces and places. Now she's the creator of the project 222 Forgotten Cities, a series of photographs focused on capturing the beauty and struggle of marginalized communities of color across the U.S. KALW's Jen Sheehan spoke with Brittany Sensabaugh about the project.
Tell me about your project, 222 Forgotten Cities.
Okay. So I was doing fashion photography. I moved to New York when I was 20. I'm now 26. So I was living there for 6 years.
And you grew up in East Oakland,
right? So I'm from East Oakland. So I was there and I was doing fashion photography. And I found it to start lacking substance. You know, even when I started doing it in Oakland, I was doing it for the love of the expression and the storytelling and not necessarily the garment. But, you know, just because New York is the fashion capital, a lot of the times it was more on the trends and like the price tag. And I didn't care for that at all. That wasn't the reason why I was doing it. So it started to lack substance to me. So around the same time, I was on a subway train. And I was wearing my Oakland hoodie. And this was around the time, too, that the crime rate had came out. So I think Oakland was number 1 or 2. Chicago was under Oakland. But Oakland was on there. And it was, like, part of top 5. And there was a Caucasian lady sitting across from me, and she pointed to my hoodie, and you know, she was like, don't ever go to that place if you've never been. Like, if you've never been in that place, don't ever go, because there's nothing but thugs and gangbangers and drug dealers there. And, you know, I was just like, wow. So I let her go on, you know, because she was entitled to, you know, her perspective, I guess. But she was entitled to her perspective. So I let her go on. And, you know, when I was getting off the train, I stopped her and I said, you know, I'm from Oakland. And not only am I from Oakland, I am from East Oakland. And I am none of those things that you are, you know, that you said about Oakland. And not only am I none of those things, I know a lot of people that are none of those things as well. And on top of that, a lot of the people that are classified as those things, there is a reason why those things are happening. So in that moment, I thought to myself, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I am going to plant seeds to change the perception. And maybe not even change the perception, because a lot of the times, like, you cannot change, you know, everyone's perception, but to present a new perception and to present evidence of things that the mainstream media isn't showing. From that conversation, like 3 months later, I went and I started documenting Oakland, which is my first series.
So you were then home?
So I was in, when I had that conversation, I was in New York. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to Oakland 3 months later. And I remember like waking up one day while I was at home.
And the incident was still bothering
you. It was still, yeah. And, you know, I hadn't, it kind of like, because 3 months had went by. So I always thought about it in my subconscious. But like consciously, I was laying down. I saw my brother's camera, the camera that he had given to me. I said to myself, I need to get up right now and I need to go shoot. And I didn't know what, but I literally got up. I took my camera and I started to shoot. I started just walking down the street and just capturing moments.
And so what did having the camera with you, what difference did that make for you and how you saw things?
So having the camera was a way for me to freeze the moment that I was seeing to show, you know, other people that this is what we are living in and this is the why. Because I consider my documentations the why that the media is leaving out. So they say like there is, you know, they'll put out the crime rate, oh, there's killings and there's drugs inside of, you know, certain areas. But why are these things happening? We are not, we don't have the access to get the drugs. Where are the drugs coming from? And what is the psychological state that the people that are living in these conditions, why do they want to kill? Why are they so angry? It is a root. And my photography shows the root of it. It is the root of why these things are happening. But it's also showing that it's not just negative things happening. There's so much. For every two negative things, there are three positive things happening in these areas. And I have proof. I shoot it every day.
Your work has drawn some comparison to Gordon Parks, the great photographer mm-hmm. and photojournalist for Life magazine. How do you feel about that? Was he an inspiration to you?
You know what? He was an inspiration. He still is an inspiration. I wouldn't say was. He still is. You know, because what he did is, you know, in many ways, when people compare us, he was documenting the times. He was also planting seeds. He planted a seed for me. Because I look back at a lot of his documentations and I see a lot hasn't changed. Number one, it shows me that. It also shows me he was very transparent. He was there. You know, you can tell that he was in these households that he documented. He wasn't just there for a day. He was really spending like time with these people, with the people that he was documenting. And I do the same. You know, I spend up to a week to a month. It's not just I go in and I go out. Because it's home. Anywhere where I document, it's home. Whether it's Oakland, it's Chicago, Baltimore, Philly, Houston, Chicago, it's all home. Yeah, it's his photography reminded me also to be unapologetic, like to not apologize for what I have to document. You know, my people feel like they have to apologize for who they are. And it's because society makes them feel like they have to apologize for who they are and for them questioning the system that we are in, you know? And I feel like with his photography, like, it left room for no questions because it was what it was, but it then, in the same breath, like, made you question, like, what was going, like, what's happening, you know? It brought,
like what you were saying earlier, the questioning the root causes. Yeah, well, why the are these people in this situation?
Exactly.
One of the things that I think is so great about your work is how you can show the beauty and also the struggle simultaneously. So you are both celebrating, but also not celebrating the beauty, but not looking away from the hard realities.
Yeah, because, you know, that is what makes us beautiful, because we are in such destructive conditions daily and we survive. Barely, though, mentally, it's a struggle. And it's beyond the physical, though. Physically, we are struggling. Our conditions, like, as far as our communities, our house being destroyed, like, but mentally, it's a mental struggle. The main thing is I want them to, you know, I want my people, when they look at my documentations, to gain back the strength and the power that they, that each day is removed from them by being in this society and matrix system, you know, like the power to wake up and look at an image that shows you your beauty and your worth, bringing back that worth that we are lacking.
That was Brittany Sensabaugh talking with KLW's Jen Chien. You can see Sensabaugh's photos and hear a conversation with her live on stage at Sights and Sounds of East Oakland, KLW's free celebration of neighborhood arts and artists, this Sunday at 3 p.m. at Laney College Theater. For more information and to RSVP for tickets, go to sightsandsoundslive.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KLW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you a particularly creepy sound.
So here's another example of queen termites. So you can see it's got this tiny little brown body here, and the white stuff is just her abdomen full of eggs.
Oh my God.
Look at that spider.
Ew. So we have one of the world's best collection of bed bugs.
All these guys.
You gotta lift up the things, remember?
It's a sound you can hear in the basement of the Life Sciences building at UC Berkeley. We sent reporter Mary Lee Williams to explore, and here's what she found.
Okay, what we can see is just columns and columns of wooden drawers.
That's Peter Obojski. He's the collections manager for the Essex Museum of Entomology. And tucked away in those wooden drawers are his specimens, roughly 6 million of them.
I have some examples right over here we can take a look at.
Oh my goodness. Oh my God. Those are massive.
They're dead. Don't worry.
Oh my God. Those are the biggest bugs I have ever seen.
We're looking in a drawer filled with giant, shiny beetles, part of what's called the Oh My collection, which showcases large, flashy insects. One is about the size of my iPhone.
Put this drawer back up here.
They're freaky big, but they're also kind of pretty.
The way they're displayed, every leg, every segment of the antennae are very carefully arranged, and that is because the people who collected these are beetle enthusiasts.
Yes, beetle enthusiasts. Amateur insect collectors who spend their free time capturing and delicately preserving these bugs.
And every specimen to them has to be a work of art.
Sometimes the beetle fans donate their treasures to the museum. But a lot of the collection comes from research projects. After students or professors conduct a study, they have to put their specimens somewhere.
It's a repository for people's research.
So what's now called the Essex Museum opened in 1939. But some of the insects predate the museum, going back hundreds of years. It even has ground beetles from one well-known beetle enthusiast, Charles Darwin.
Those were specimens he collected while on the voyage of the Beagle to Tierra del Fuego.
Darwin's beetles are tiny, maybe half an inch, very different from the Theraphosa blondii, which is also part of the Omai collection.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Commonly known as the Goliath bird eater.
Oh, that's so terrifying!
It's the largest spider in the world. Open your hand and spread out your fingers. The bird eater is about that big.
So the name is suggestive of something pretty spectacular, jumping out of trees and catching birds, but actually they're eating chicks and nests.
But you can't just pop by to see this giant spider. The Essig Museum of Entomology isn't open to the public. One reason is there isn't enough space.
So where I have the displays for some of our events is the same place I do all my work. So the option is work or talk to the public. I can't do both at the same time.
Most of the work that happens here isn't on the Goliath level. It's more like flies and bed bugs.
So I'm having a great time getting back in touch with my bugs.
That's Paul Rude. He studied entomology at Berkeley in 1980, but left the field to work as a general contractor. About a year and a half ago, he started volunteering here.
Really, all I'm doing is I'm taking these out one by one. I'm taking this fly out, and then I'm putting it under the microscope.
He is chipping away at a backlog of uncatalogued flies called Diptera.
What I'm looking for is particular indications of whether it belongs to certain groups.
When he figures that out, he drops each fly into the proper drawer and gets another. Rude's been into bugs since he was a kid. He started by collecting butterflies. When he ran out of those, he branched out to flies.
You know, from a distance, they all look the same, and who cares? But when you take the time to look at them individually, you'll find they're extremely bizarre. Many of them have very odd features and different colors.
Most volunteers, like Rude, want to focus on a certain insect or kind of task, sorting scorpion flies, say, or pinning specimens. Peter Obojski, the collections manager, studies small moths from Pacific Islands. But he says his focus doesn't matter. He likes learning about insects.
That's why I love working in the museum, it's a collection of stories. There's a story in every drawer, and I find that fascinating.
That means researchers like Obojski could discover a new species of bed bug or find a now extinct butterfly that's perfectly preserved, depending on which drawer they open. For Cross Currents, I'm Mary Lee Williams.
Bugs! You can actually check them out yourself this weekend. The Essig Museum's open to the public for Cal Day. For more information, head to kalw.org, click on Audiograph. Our winner this week is Holly Forbes. Way to go, Holly! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, here's a sneak listen at next week's Mystery Sound.
This is burning money and as part of the offering so that they can use it in the other side of the world.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. Are you an Audiograph fan? Subscribe to our podcast. You can hear Cross Currents whenever you want and catch up on past episodes. You can even search our shows by subject. Find out how at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rollins, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by James Henry and Hands on Fire from San Francisco. Henry works to keep both African culture and the art of drumming alive. And you can hear him do just that when James Henry and Hands on Fire perform Saturday night at Phoenix Bar and Grill in Santa Rafael. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.